I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Today, civilization is once again at a crucial turning point. A real war has once again been unleashed against our homeland.
Russian President Vladimir Putin accuses the West of unleashing a war against Russia during a Victory Day celebration in Moscow, marking the Soviet defeat of the Nazis in World War II. As Russia launches waves of drone strikes against Ukraine and Kyiv prepares for a major counteroffensive, the Biden administration is sending another $1.2 billion of weapons to Ukraine. Should the U.S. be pushing for peace talks? We'll speak to Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, then to Sudan, where the humanitarian crisis is worsening as fighting between rival military factions enters its 25th day.
Essentially, both of them now are in a battle to the death. They conceive it as a zero-sum game. The Sudanese population throughout the country is held hostage to the ambitions, the political and economic ambitions of these two generals.
And protests are continuing over the death of Jordan Neely, a longtime New York street performer who was choked to death by a former Marine on a subway car moments after Neely screamed out he was hungry and thirsty. The medical examiner has ruled his death a homicide, but no charges have been filed. We'll speak with an activist with the group Vocal New York and another street performer who knew Jordan from his time when he worked as a Michael Jackson impersonator. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 13 people were killed in the Gaza Strip overnight as Israeli forces targeted a residential apartment building in Gaza City. Al Jazeera reports three commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad were among the dead, along with their wives and children. This is a Gaza resident.
People have not been able to sleep since 4 o'clock in the morning. The children woke up to the sound of explosions and they were terrified. We have children, women, patients, and elderly people. This is not normal.
Israel's latest attack comes just a week after Israeli airstrikes rained down on the besieged Gaza Strip following rocket launches from Gaza in response to the death of Palestinian hunger striker Hadar Adnan while in an Israeli prison. Russian President Vladimir Putin has lashed out against the U.S. and other Western powers over their support for Ukraine, saying that a real war is underway against Russia. Putin made the remarks during a brief Victory Day speech in Moscow's Red Square, commemorating the 78th anniversary of the Soviet defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II.
Today, civilization is once again at a crucial turning point. A real war has once again been unleashed against our homeland, but we have fought back against international terrorism.
Overnight, air raid sirens sounded across two-thirds of Ukraine as Russia launched more than a dozen missile attacks on Kyiv and other cities. Ukraine's government says at least four people were killed Monday. The latest attacks came as European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen arrived in Kyiv for talks with the Ukrainian president. Meanwhile, the Biden administration's announcing an additional $1.2 billion in military aid to Ukraine today for air defense systems and drones. We'll speak with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. In Sudan, fighting continues to rage in Khartoum as representatives for the national military and the paramilitary rapid support forces hold talk in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. On Monday, Sudan's military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, ruled out any peace settlement unless both warring parties agree to a lasting ceasefire. At least 700 people have been killed, while over 100,000 people have fled Sudan since fighting broke out 3 weeks ago. We'll go to Sudan later in the broadcast. In Pakistan, former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been arrested in the capital, Islamabad, during a court appearance where he faces corruption charges. Security forces dragged Khan out of court and into a police vehicle. allies denounced his arrest as an abduction. Khan was removed from the office by parliament in April of last year. In recent months, hundreds of his supporters blocked repeated attempts by Pakistani authorities to take Khan into custody. He's denied the charges against him. In Serbia, tens of thousands of people joined protests against gun violence in the capital, Belgrade, Monday, demanding top government officials resign in the wake of the two mass shootings last week. 17 people were killed in the two attacks, including 8 school children. This is protester Slobodan Selaković.
It is tragic that so many kids killed by their peers were buried in a short period of time. This is a low point. We are already used to what happens in Texas, but there, weapons are openly purchased. And here, where do they get the firearms? It is a disaster.
In Texas, public anger is growing over the lack of information being shared by investigators as they piece together details about the 33-year-old gunman who killed 8 people and wounded 7 others during a mass shooting in the Dallas suburb of Allen Saturday. In social media posts, the gunman revealed he had a swastika and an SS symbol tattooed on his body. He frequently espoused racist views, including praise for Adolf Hitler and other mass killers. In 2008, the gunman joined the U.S. Army but was terminated 3 months later for unspecified mental health issues. Despite that, the gunman never faced a background check before legally purchasing firearms from private sellers in Texas, including the AR-15 assault rifle used in the attack. On Monday, more victims of the massacre were identified. They include Daniela and Sofia Mendoza, 2 elementary school-age sisters whose mother was shot and remains in critical condition, and Kyosung and Cindy Cho, a Korean-American couple who were killed along with their 3-year-old son, James. Their 6-year-old son, William, is in the hospital. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have already been 202 mass shootings in the United States this year, on average, more than 1 mass shooting per day. Elsewhere in Texas, authorities have charged the driver of the SUV who rammed into a crowd of migrants outside a shelter in the border city of Brownsville on Sunday, killing 8 people and wounding 10 others. Most of the victims were Venezuelan asylum seekers who'd spent the night at the shelter and were waiting to board a bus. This is Brownsville Police Chief Felix Salsada.
Investigation also revealed that the driver of the vehicle, later identified as George Alvarez, November 9th, 1988, had attempted to flee the scene after impact, but was held down by several individuals on scene. He has been formally charged and arraigned with 8 counts of manslaughter, 10 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon.
Police say Alvarez had a long history of violent crimes, including aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. They're investigating eyewitness accounts that he shouted anti-immigrant insults at his victims during Sunday's assault. Venezuela's government has called for an investigation to determine if the attack was motivated by hate. In related news, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has deployed another 450 National Guard soldiers to the southern border with Mexico as the Biden administration prepares to lift the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy Thursday. Abbott said the new units targeting asylum seekers will be stationed in the borderlands of El Paso and the Rio Grande Valley.
The Texas National Guard is loading Black Hawk helicopters and C-130s, deploying specially trained National Guard members for the Texas Tactical Border Force. They will be deployed to hot spots along the border to intercept, to repel, and to turn back migrants who are trying to enter Texas illegally.
Meanwhile, in California, dozens of asylum seekers have been stranded at the southern border near San Diego, as many hope to be allowed into the United States after the lifting of Title 42, which for 3 years has been used to expel almost 3 million migrants at the border without due process. Humanitarian aid volunteers brought food and water as asylum seekers had not eaten for days.
We have been meeting with people who've been here up to 7 days. There is a very young baby here that's been here. I know was here yesterday. There are a number of young children. They are being provided with minimal water, insufficient water. They've not been given food today and very little food yesterday.
Here in New York, jurors have begun deliberations in Donald Trump's rape and defamation civil trial brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. During closing arguments Monday, Carroll's attorney described Trump as a habitual liar and sex abuser who ruined Carroll's reputation after she accused him of raping her in a department store dressing room in the 1990s. 11 witnesses testified for the plaintiff, including two other women, who said Trump also sexually assaulted them. Trump had promised to disprove Carroll's allegations in court, but decided to not attend the trial. A new report finds South Carolina Democratic Congressmember Jim Clyburn secretly worked with Republicans during the 2020 redistricting process in a plan that diluted black voting strength and harmed Democrats' chances of gaining seats in Congress. That's according to ProPublica, which reports Clyburn made the deal in exchange for a redrawn map of South Carolina's 6th congressional district that ensured he could easily win re-election. A spokesperson denied the report that Clyburn facilitated Republican gerrymandering. Until January, Clyburn served as House Majority Whip, the third-ranking House Democrat. His opposition to Bernie Sanders' candidacy helped propel Joe Biden to victory in 2020 presidential primary. And here in New York, 11 people were arrested at a protest Monday night demanding justice for Jordan Neely, a 30-year-old unhoused black man who was choked to death on a subway car last week by another passenger. Jordan Neely was crying out that he was hungry when he was fatally attacked on the train by a 24-year former Marine named Daniel Penny. Penny was interviewed by police detectives, but was released, not arrested. Sunday night's protest follows a similar demonstration Saturday when police arrested 13 people at a sit-in protest demanding that Penny face charges. They were on the subway tracks. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused the West of unleashing a war against Russia during a Victory Day celebration in Moscow marking the Soviet defeat of the Nazis 78 years ago. Putin's remarks came over 14 months after Russia invaded Ukraine. In recent days, Russia's stepped up attacks on Ukraine, launching waves of drone and missile attacks targeting Kyiv and other areas. Putin spoke in Moscow's Red Square earlier today.
Today, civilization is once again at a crucial turning point. A real war has once again been unleashed against our homeland. But we have fought back against international terrorism. We will also protect the people of the Donbas and ensure our security. For us, for Russia, there are no unfriendly hostile nations, either in the West or the East. As with the absolute majority of people on the planet, we want to see the future peaceful, free, and stable. We believe that any ideology of supremacy is disgusting, evil, and deadly in its nature. The Western globalist elites, however, still preach about their exceptionalism. They are pitting people against each other and dividing society, provoking bloody conflicts and coups, sowing hatred, Russophobia, aggressive nationalism, destroying the traditional family values that make people people.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also marked the anniversary of the surrender of Nazi Germany in World War II. On Monday, Zelensky compared Putin's Russia to Nazi Germany.
Зло, на жаль, повернулося.
Unfortunately, evil has returned. Just as evil rushed to our cities and villages then, it is doing so now. Evil killed our people then, so it does now. Although now the aggressor is different. The goal is the same, enslavement or destruction. And just like in the Second World War, we are not alone against evil. We fight against him together in the same way, with the entire free world, with the states and peoples who created a joint victory at that time. We fought then, and we fight now, so that no one ever again enslaves other peoples and destroys other countries. And the old evil that modern Russia is bringing back will be defeated, just as Nazism was defeated.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's remarks come as Ukraine is preparing to launch a major counteroffensive, which has forced Moscow to issue evacuation orders for thousands of residents in some areas occupied by Russian troops. Meanwhile, the Biden administration administration's announcing today a new $1.2 billion military aid package for Ukraine. To talk more about the war in Ukraine, we're joined by Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis, welcome back to Democracy Now! So let's start there. As this counteroffensive begins by Ukraine and Russia rains down strikes on Ukraine, the U.S. is announcing today another $1.2 billion in military aid to Ukraine. Where do you see this going?
Good morning, Amy. I'm afraid that what we're looking at is already collapsed into a war of attrition. The analogies to World War II are dangerous on a number of levels, but one of the levels is that this is not a war that's going to end like World War II with the surrender of one side or another. I think there is widespread understanding that this is not a war that's going to be won militarily. The question is, how long is it going to be prolonged? How many more Ukrainian civilians and also Russian soldiers that have been forced into the military are going to be killed? How much more Ukrainian territory is going to be destroyed? How much more of a global set of consequences, including the environmental consequences, the economic crisis, and the famine that is attacking large parts of the global south because of the consequences of this war? All of that, and the potential threat of an escalation to a nuclear exchange, the most dangerous and the most deadly possibility that could come from this. So all of that is possible. And I think that looking at the question of the new looming Ukrainian offensive, there's been talk also of a Russian offensive in the spring, although that isn't as clear as the possibility of a Ukrainian offensive. The real issue is, for how long is this war going to end, and what should be the position of our movements, movements of progressives, of anti-war forces, of anti-empire forces, those who support Ukraine's right of self-determination, and yet see the consequences of this war going forward? If our goal, as I think it should be, is to end the war, not to extend it indefinitely, as long as it takes, as President Biden describes it, by providing all the weapons that Ukraine might ask for, all of the weapons of any sort between the U.S. and its allies, this is going to make things worse and not better. It's going to extend the war and not lead towards a way of ending the war, which I think has to be our goal.
What nations do you believe could play a role in negotiations?
I think first there has to be a coming together of a number of nations to call for a ceasefire. A ceasefire is the immediate demand. It won't lead to justice by itself. But if the end of the shooting can happen, if the end of the bombing can happen, if people are no longer being killed, there is a much better chance that serious negotiations could get underway. I think there are a number of countries that could play a role in a positive way. The Chinese 12-point program that was submitted some time ago, I think by itself is not sufficient. It didn't, for example, say that the Russian troops must be withdrawn. It didn't acknowledge the illegality of the Russian invasion. That's a serious problem. But it did include a number of components which even the Ukrainian leadership has said they could accept. At the level of who's moving around the world trying to put forward a new call for negotiations, the initiative taken by Brazilian President Lula, I think, is one of the most important, partnered potentially with the South African president. President Ramaphosa and President Lula together would be a very formidable team. They both have relations with both Russia and Ukraine. They both are part of the BRICS alliance, but they're the only ones of the BRICS who are not either fighting or providing weapons or trying to provide weapons to one or both sides. So they're in a particularly useful position in terms of being able to negotiate, being able to engage with both sides, to act as an interlocutor. We have not yet heard that there's a team in formation, if you will, between Lula and Ramaphosa. But I think President Lula in particular has been very visible in moving around the world calling for this. He's someone with a long history of engagement on international issues beyond Brazil's own borders. And South Africa has made very clear their both opposition to the Russian invasion, but refusing to accept the U.S.-led calls for sanctions and other punishments that are known to not work to end wars. So I think there is a great potential there for those two leaders to play a major role.
Would Ukraine accept South Africa, which hasn't condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as it is conducting naval exercises with the Russian and Chinese navies in the Indian Ocean? And would they accept Brazil, which claimed that the U.S. is stimulating the fighting, and would you agree with that, and said that both Ukraine and Russia had decided to go to war?
I think that there's no question that the U.S. provision of military equipment, of arms, of tanks, of support of all kinds, and U.S. allies providing the rest, potentially even including long-range missiles we're hearing today, something the U.S. has refused to do, but now Britain is talking about that as a possibility. There's no question that that has extended the war. I think that there is a mistaken view out there that says that South Africa has never condemned the war. There has been a criticism of the war. What South Africa has not been prepared to do is vote for the condemnations in the Security Council that came along with calls for specific sanctions, et cetera, against Russia, which they were not prepared to do. I think that there is a good chance that the Ukrainian leadership would accept almost any serious negotiations at this point. One of the issues is, will their key military backers, particularly the United States, pull back from their earlier positions of telling the Ukrainians, essentially, we don't want a ceasefire yet. We're not pushing you to negotiate. There was a period last April, more than a year ago, in April of 2022, when there were negotiations that were seemed to be pending. There were discussions about talks about talks, if you will. And at that point, with U.S. Involvement, the then Prime Minister of the U.K., Boris Johnson, went to Kyiv to meet with President Zelensky, and all the reports indicated that his message was, don't start negotiating yet. We will provide you with whatever you need. Keep the fight going. And that was indeed what the Ukrainians chose to do. That has not made it better in terms of the potential for future negotiations. And of course, we are also facing a serious challenge with our movement in the differences between those who support one set of legitimate rights of Ukraine as the most important aspects, and others who support other rights of Ukraine and the world as the more important. And there's been such tension within that movement that it's been almost impossible to build a unified effort to end this war. So we're facing a very challenging moment when the urgency for a ceasefire, the urgency for moving towards negotiations is crucial, and yet there's problems of a stall in our movement level. There's a stall at the diplomatic level. The only thing that's not being stalled is sending more weapons. And I think that's a very serious problem, because what we're looking at, Amy, one of the challenges that we face is this enormous contradiction of this period of history, where it's not only complicated because this is no longer the Cold War, where there was U.S. imperialism attacking countries, undermining the self-determination of countries around the world, and much of the rest of the world mobilized against that, and political movements mobilized on the same side, not necessarily agreeing with what the Soviet Union at that time was doing or saying, or what China at that time was doing or saying, but clear in our opposition to what the U.S. was doing around the world. What we're seeing now is that illegitimate actions, illegal actions, violations of international law are coming not only from the U.S. In this case, they're coming from Russia as well. We also have to understand, I think, that there are two separate wars being waged in Ukraine, one of which has been waged for decades now, led by the United States and NATO, as a geopolitical war against Russian influence in the post-Cold War era with the collapse of the Soviet Union. That included things like the movement of NATO into countries much closer to Russia, despite promises not to do so. It includes the positioning of weapons across Europe, including strategic weapons and even nuclear weapons in parts of Europe. So all of that has been one kind of geopolitical war. As of last year, and beginning in some ways in 2014 with the Russian invasion and occupation of Crimea, you have a Russian-led war on the ground. And it's that ground war right now that so urgently needs to be stopped, because that's where we're seeing the deaths of just too many people, too many Ukrainian civilians, elders and children, babies, everyone is at risk of being killed or injured in this war. So there's a desperate, urgent need to stop that war. But we can't put aside the fact that there's been this other geopolitical war led by the United States and NATO, which is still going on. So we can't simply wish that away and say, by concentrating on the ground war, which I believe needs to be our priority, a war in which Russia was clearly the aggressor, we need to focus on that. But keeping in mind the other part of this very complicated set of wars that are underway. So I think the call for an immediate ceasefire and the call for serious negotiations that first will lead to a peace with justice in the medium and long term after an immediate ceasefire. We can't afford, I'm afraid, to say we can put off a ceasefire until a fully realized peace with justice is on the way.
And what do you say, Phyllis?
What that leaves—
What do you say, Phyllis, to those who say a ceasefire serves Russia because they get to keep their land that they have occupied from Donbass to Crimea?
A ceasefire is only step one. A ceasefire is only the prelude to negotiations, which should lead to Russian troops being pulled out. That's a goal. But in almost every case, there are exceptions in history. The U.S. negotiated with Vietnam for 5 years while the worst of the fighting continued between 1968 and 1973. But that's a rarity in history. In almost every situation, serious negotiations don't take place until there's a ceasefire. We're not talking about Russia being allowed somehow to keep territory it has claimed. That's a clear violation of international law in a whole host of ways. But it's a step. It's a necessary step. We can't leave out that it's only step one, that the next step has to be moving towards serious negotiations. There also need to be separate negotiations in which the United States, first of all, has no right to tell the Ukrainians what they should do in the negotiations. But as its main supplier of arms, of money, of all kinds of support, it has, in my view, not only the right but the obligation to push Ukraine towards negotiations, as at the same time that the world is pushing the Russians towards negotiations.
And Phyllis, there needs to be negotiations. On the issue of debate within countries, you travel around the world. How does that debate in Europe, do you see it more robust and open than in the United States? You work with many Congress members. The issue of negotiation ceasefire is rarely publicly raised here, unless we're talking about protesters on the ground getting arrested.
I think it's a very complicated question. I have not been traveling around since COVID, although that's about to change. But in my talk by phone and by Skype with colleagues in anti-war forces and progressive people of all kinds across Europe and elsewhere, there is debate and discussion. But I think that the levels of support for arming Ukraine in an almost unlimited way is as great or greater across Europe than it is here. There is an active and vibrant peace mobilization in Europe, and yet the public polls indicate great support for further arming, further weapons being sent, the expansion of NATO. In the new countries that are moving into NATO, Finland and Sweden, where the populations for decades prided themselves on their non-alignment with war-making forces around the world, including the United States. In that context, we're now seeing a complete reversal, where the government decisions to join NATO in both Finland and Sweden, which is now in process, has enormously high levels of public support. So I think that we're in a similar situation here, where there is a great deal of support for Ukraine, a level of support that I think is appropriate in terms of supporting a population that has been attacked and occupied by an outside aggressive force, that being Russia. But at the same time, we're not seeing that same level of support for sending the amount of money. It's over $66 billion just on the military side so far, and it's about to be $67 billion, another $50 billion or so in economic aid. There's a lot of opposition.